and welcome to Worlds Apart. The last 3 years of Western economic warfare against Russia haven't yet delivered a fatal blow to the Kremlin, but it has dramatically changed the functioning of the global and particularly the Western economies. Escaping Washington's friendly fire and cutting losses are now preoccupying concerns for America's own allies, while the rest of the world is actively experimenting with new ways of doing business outside Western bondage. Where are we heading from here? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Dejan Šoškić, professor at Belgrade University's Faculty of Economics and former governor of the National Bank of Serbia. Mr. Šoškić, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, we are recording this interview after the BRICS summit in Russia, which brought together not only the leaders of major developing economies, but pretty much the entire global South. And I think what was very important about the summit is that it not only shattered the Western narrative of Russia's isolation, but far more crucially, I think it strengthened those countries' confidence that they can deal with one another, regardless of how Uncle Sam feels about it. Do you think that's important?
Well, yes, I do. You know, I believe that we are all living in a world in which there is perhaps systematic disinformation about the economic power of certain countries in the world. And I believe that West is still living in the 70s and 80s concerning their relative economic strength. You know, if we look at the data from the World Bank, we see basically a different picture if we take into consideration gross domestic product, which is corrected for the purchasing power parity. That really brings a lot of, I would say, grounds for additional confidence on the side of the emerging markets, especially for the BRICS countries.
Mm-hmm. The West is not only not as powerful as it used to be, but I think one of the points you often make in your articles and in your interviews is that it's actually wasting its power that it has at this point of time counterproductively to try to hurt Russia or China, but it ends up hurting its own allies or its own economies. Why do you think this rationale persists? Why do you think the West is not so good at accounting for the consequences of its own actions for its own base, for its own allies, or for itself?
Yes, well, I believe that there is a widespread inertia about the role of the West in the global economy, and I think that that basically is from historical facts of the end of the Second World War, when the United States economy was really a dominant one. All of the other potential competitors were actually heavily destroyed during the war itself. So in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, the global dominance of the United States was not in question, and European powers in the West European domain have also recovered. So the dominance of G7 was, you can say, undisputed. However, nowadays, if people would like to really take into consideration adequate measures of economic power, and that is gross domestic product, but not nominal, but corrected with purchasing power parity, and that is a very important distinction to have in mind, because purchasing power parity actually takes into consideration the difference in relative level of internal prices in economies that you would like to compare. So therefore, if you use the GDP corrected for the purchasing power parity, and you look for that in the, let's say, World Bank data or IMF data and so on, you see a very different picture. You see basically that among the four largest economies in the world, three are actually members of BRICS today, China, India, and Russia, Russia being fourth, India being third, China being first. And on the second place, you see United States basically lagging behind China, roughly about 20%. However, you know, West is still very important. But at the end of the game, you know, Western Europe has always been heavily reliant on importing energy to a certain extent, you know, raw materials, even food and so on. And those are the things that basically Russia has been a proven provider of these commodities in the global market, especially serving the needs of Europe. And I believe that sanctions coming from the country, which has basically experienced sanctions some 20, 30 years back, I do recall those those times as very, very, problematic times for my country. But at the same time, we saw that the effects can actually really be, detrimental for the small economy. But for the large economy, like for instance, Russia is today like 6.45 trillion US dollars, and with the structure of the economy which Russia has, and with the very low level of debt to GDP which Russia has, and also, let's say, the surplus in trade balance.
Well, Mr. Shushkic, if I may, yes. I do want to discuss the particularities of Russia's economic relationship with Europe a little bit later, but before we move there, can I ask you a couple of questions about BRICS? Because I think one of BRICS' main distinctions is that it wasn't created to counter anything, including the much criticized Western economic and financial order. Its main purpose for existence is essentially to advance the interests of its member states. It's very practically oriented. It's not against, it is for. And yet we are seeing a lot of adversarial attitude towards BRICS from Western media and from Western politicians. Why do you think the West still sees BRICS in antagonistic terms? Because BRICS countries are primarily preoccupied with themselves rather than with the West.
It seems to me that their view of things is, if you are not with us, you are against us. You cannot be basically neutral. You cannot have these ties with various important centers of global influence. But you need to be basically part of just one club. And I do not see that it's a good option for many countries. I do know that it's maybe not a good option for my country, but I see also that a large country like India also doesn't like that attitude, and many others, you know. This type of tribalistic way of thinking in global domain, I don't believe that there is a bright future for that. And BRICS is basically giving us a different approach that I believe is a more rational one.
Well, to some extent it's different, but on the other side, it's also very similar to what the West advocated in the past, because BRICS is a fairly loose organization, and it stands by certain values, like, for example, practicality over ideology, mutual respect, freedom of choice, focus on development. And those are some of those values used to be praised in the West a couple of decades ago, but not anymore. How do you understand this turnaround?
A lot of things can change in the West. You know, we looking from the edge of Europe, from the Southeast Europe, we were always aspiring towards European values. You know, the liberal society with human rights, democracy, wealthy countries with good living standards, and so on. There was a lot of attractiveness, and there was, a higher level of intention to be fair in international relationship. I mean, let's recall end of 1980s and the beginning of 1990s. You know, it wasn't a surprise to see and hear politicians talking about the unified sphere of cooperation from Lisbon to Vladivostok and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, that, so to say, romantic period has ceased to exist during the 90s. And I see that the prevailing policies nowadays in the Western world sometimes basically undermine the core values that they have been advocating for decades.
Mm-hmm. Now, this romantic vision of Europe and perhaps more broadly of the world was also based on the premise is that everyone would be able to partake in the common growth. But when I try to analyze Western attitude towards growth or development right now, it seems rather jealous. Western countries seem to be very adversarial or jealous of other countries' growth, whereas BRICS seems to be taking a different attitude. It's more sort of laid back, and there is a recognition that the prosperity of your neighbor also contributes to your own stability. So I wonder which of these developmental paradigms, because these are very two different ways of looking at the world, win-win versus win-lose, which of these two do you think may prevail over time? And I'm asking that not as a rhetorical question, but as an economic one.
Well, you know, if we recall, for instance, the end of the First World War, when there was a Versailles conference, and one of the very prominent members of the British delegation at that time, a famous economist, John Maynard Keynes, actually advocated for not humiliating Germany and allowing Germany to grow as a potential market for British, French, and other producers, and not to impose huge, war repayments and such. He was unfortunately in minority, and he very much disappointed, decided to pull away from those peace talks and wrote a famous book, The Economic Consequences of Peace. So from the economic perspective, there is a win-win situation. There is not necessarily a zero-sum game in international relations, because our neighbor and the others, which are the countries that we are cooperating with, if they're growing, then that's also the potential for the markets for our producers to grow. So in cooperation, I believe it should be commonly understood, especially by the countries in the West, which had advocated for free trade for decades back. It should be quite obvious that in more cooperation, economic freedom and trade, there is an opportunity for all to grow and for the, common benefit.
There's not only an opportunity for all to grow, but also a very strong advantage for the West, and particularly for the United States, which used its currency promoted its currency as the universal global currency. But you have written a lot about the fact that this weaponization of the dollar, its use as an instrument of unilateral or bloc sanctions, is bad not only for the financial system, it's bad for the West itself. How long do you think it will be unless the West actually sees the negative consequences of that?
Well, the negative consequences are already seen to a certain extent.
Well, they may be seen, but not recognized, at least, in policymaking.
Well, you can see that a lot of people, including Paul Krugman and the others, are saying something like, dollar is there to stay for a long period ahead and so on. Talking in a way that it's the only system available and the only system possible. However, if we look back in history, again, coming to the peace conference and in Bretton Woods, we remember that even at that time, the dollar as a main international currency had a competitor in the British model, also advocated by previously mentioned John Maynard Keynes, and that is to create an international currency, which is not going to be the currency of any individual state. And there is a very good reason for that. We have seen in the past couple of years, again, the reaffirmation of why it is not good to have any national currency also serving the purpose of international money for making payments, transactions, and keeping reserves. We have seen that because inflation from the US actually has spilled over into the rest of the economy. Also, when the US is, for their internal purposes, raising interest rates to, let's say, curb local inflation in the US, they're at the same time influencing all of the countries which need to raise debt denominated in US dollars. They need to compete with these higher interest rates, and some of these countries simply cannot financially survive such a pressure. And that has been the case, for instance, in the 1980s, when a lot of emerging economies have fallen into emerging public debt crisis due to the fact that at that time, the United States was dealing with their own internal inflation. Paul Walker was basically curbing down inflation in the United States with very, very high interest rates. So there are a lot of negative spillovers coming from the fact that one national currency, in this case, US dollar, is being used as a currency for international trade. That's also bringing about the huge trade deficit for the US and a lot of other, let's say, potential shortcomings, like, let's say, clearing and settlements happen in New York, sometimes thousands and thousands of kilometers away from the purchaser and buyer of certain goods, maybe in Africa and Asia, Latin America, and so on.
Okay. Well, Mr. Shoshkich, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Music.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dejan Šoškić, former governor of the National Bank of Serbia. Mr. Šoškić, just before the break, we were talking about inconveniences associated with having the US dollar as the main reserve currency of the globe. But let's admit, it's also pretty, well, universal in use. And I know that even among the BRICS countries, I've seen some statistics that up to 65% of the trade is settled in alternative ways, in bilateral currencies or in some other mechanisms. But whenever it's possible, BRICS countries also trade in dollar because it is convenient. Do you think it can ever be fully replaced? And if so, by what?
Well, concerning the replacements, I mean, we need to also have in mind that before 1944, in Bretton Woods initiative, there were other ways of settling international transactions. I mean, we also have from that period of time after the First World War, the Bank for International Settlements, which was one of the institutions actually put in place to facilitate these trades, which were at that time not conducted in US dollars. Let me remind you, because dollar actually was not the dominant global currency before the Second World War. So alternatives are obviously there. You know, you can trade in your local currency. You can potentially create a unit of account, for instance, something like the SDR or something like that. You can also maybe think further and try to create an international currency which would be capable of also increasing in volume on its own as the international trade grows, like John Maynard Keynes envisaged in his Bancor model. So I believe that that initiative is something that might be addressed again. There was a group of US economists after the great financial crisis of 2007 and 8, among which was Stiglitz and some other people, Nobel laureates. They were discussing the possibility of creating the global currency, the world money, which wouldn't be dollar, which would be something else. And I believe that now, from perspective of these recent events, you know, the blockage of funds of sovereign nations in their reserves in dollars, euros, and other Western currencies, there is now, let's say, an additional impetus to revisit this idea. I believe that there is potential. However, it's not easy to make really a solid alternative in a very short period of time. But this process, in any case, needs to be gradual and is normal, since the relative importance of US economy has been on the decline for decades back.
Interesting. And I think that process is already moving. I mean, it has not produced any result yet, but there were plenty of such discussions at the BRICS summit. Now, speaking of which, BRICS was developing as an international grouping even before the conflict in Ukraine entered its kinetic active phase. But I think it's pretty clear that it got a very substantial impetus with the start of the war and with the introduction of Western sanctions against Russia and against many other countries that are willing to trade with Russia. Do you think Western policymakers accounted for that? How thought through do you think that intention or that policy to introduce sanctions was at that time?
I have to say that more than 2 years back, in one discussion and broadcast that I had on Serbian alternative TV channels and so on, I predicted that these sanctions towards Russia will not be successful. I predicted that maybe 1 or 2 years of negative growth. It turned out just 1 year of negative growth. But I also envisaged that the country that has technology, capital, skilled labor, large internal market, and all the production of all of these essential aspects for industrialization, really, if someone wants to sanction such a country and have a success with that, I think that it's basically more wishful thinking than reality. It's too large economy with structure which is self-sustainable and enough for internal growth. Now, frankly speaking, I'm not saying that there are not negative aspects of international sanctions towards the Russian economy, and you should know that better than I do. But at the same time, you know, the economy is growing and having relatively high rates of growth, and the cooperation that is still very much vibrant with the rest of the world is something that is only helping in this process of obviously sending a message that these sanctions simply do not work.
Now, I heard you say that one of the most common mistakes that Western policymakers choose to make about Russia is claiming that it is a small or fragile economy, a gas station masquerading as a country. And clearly anyone who looked professionally at Russia's budgeting sheets, at its balancing, at its economic discipline, how it rose back after the Soviet collapse, would know that it's not accurate. And it's not only about the size of the economy, but also the skill, the effort, the thinking that went into rebuilding the country. You know, this may not be fully remunerated, but it gives country and its economy a certain strength that you cannot always sort of express in material terms. Why do you think, though, this myth of Russia's feebleness is still getting so much purchase?
Well, I think that the main reason is not understanding what GDP really is and how it can be calculated. And the fact that most people do not know that GDP is not a single indicator, but actually a family of indicators from which you need to choose the inadequate one for the analysis you want to make. So when you want to make an analysis comparing countries with very different internal level of prices and structure of the economy, you need to go to GDP corrected for the purchasing power parity. When you take that, you see basically that the Russian GDP is more than three times larger than the nominal GDP that people very frequently use. Secondly, there is no fiscal fragility. It's a fiscally disciplined country with a very, very low level of debt to GDP, much, much lower than what is present in Europe nowadays. I believe that the last figure that I found in Fiscal Monitor, which is published by the IMF, was 17% of GDP, which is far, far below the average in Europe, which is around 80%, or United States, which is now running almost 130% of GDP, the overall debt that they have. So this is, in my view, macroeconomically, country and economy that is very hard to destabilize. And people that have been talking about sanctions, I believe that they had something else in mind, you know, the smaller economies with which they had experiences previously and relative success. But I can tell you, coming from a very small economy with sanctions back in the 90s, even our economy has survived. You know, there is always a possibility to sidestep some of the sanctions. Obviously, that is much, much more a problem in a small country like Serbia than in an economy like Russia.
Mm-hmm. Now, Serbia and Russia clearly have historical ties, but I do want to ask you, as somebody who deals with hard matters of economy, I wonder if that quality of Russia to be disciplined about its financial matters or about its development is also something that attracts many of the countries to the BRICS format, because personally speaking, this is something I think that to be respected, this, you know, this quality of being not only self-sufficient, but also, you know, seeing your own weaknesses, appreciating your own strength and trying to build from that. Do you think there's any attraction in that in the world?
I think that there is a potential for the countries in the South to start realizing and understanding that with these three Eurasian economies, China, India, and Russia, you know, there is basically fewer and fewer need to cooperate with traditional West. Technology, industry, military capacity, overall economic strength, you know, it has actually shifted in geographical terms from the West to the East. And nowadays, if you really want to acquire anything that is substantial for any developing economy, I'm sure that they could, besides West, look also elsewhere and fulfill their needs in a good way. So, you know, South-South cooperation, in my view, should be increased. And also, you know, one of these very good ideas that had emerged after the Second World War, which have never been implemented, unfortunately, you know, a little bit, you know, put on the side and never really been developed. In those days, at the end of 1940s and beginning of 1950s, it was also debated about creating commodities, reserves that would keep the prices of agricultural products and other commodities relatively stable. And that was something that would have, you know, very much helped the development of underdeveloped economies. However, that didn't realized the only two institutions basically that stayed in life were World Bank and the IMF, and they have gradually basically been steered perhaps a little bit away from the real interests of the developing world.
Let me ask you one more question about attractions, because I think ever since the Soviet collapse, it was assumed that the European Union is the main attraction for all European countries, that they all want to be part of this big club because of its values, as you mentioned, because of the high living standards. And there was a sort of presumption within European, Western European politicians that they can choose whom to befriend, and they can sort of impose preconditions on countries if they want to be in some sort of a relationship with the European Union. Does this still hold true? Do you think the EU is still as attractive as it believes itself to be?
We don't really need to speculate too much. We have seen what happened with Brexit. Obviously, some people in United Kingdom, and the majority was there, obviously, in 2016, voted to get out of the EU. I'm not sure whether that was an optimal choice for the UK citizens in the long run, but it's obvious that Europe is in a sort of a crisis in terms of decision making, but also you see divisions within the EU coming from the Western Balkans. I can also say that we are waiting in line for 20 years. Nothing actually has happened. You can say that we are not getting closer by waiting in line. We are drifting away from European Union, you could say. There, to a certain extent, I believe that the European Union has a problem if it wants to be called European and at the same time to exclude the largest economy on the continent, the country which has largest territory, which has largest population and obviously a very significant military power. I do not believe that European institutions should be growing on those grounds. I believe that they need to make a shift, and we'll see whether maybe some new political structures in Europe will be more aware of that fact.
Mm-hmm. And one last question, if I may. One of the most common words I heard being voiced at the BRICS summit in Kazan was respect. And I want to ask you, as an economist, how much respect matters when it comes to relationships between various countries?
Diplomacy is such an important thing. It basically is grounded on mutual respect. And this thing is something that, unfortunately, is quite, put aside in many relationships that we have seen in the past couple of decades. There are countries, especially some in the West, that basically try to impose solutions. They are not, treating the other parties as an equal in discussions. They are not prone to discuss in a diplomatic manner and to solve problems before they erupt undesirable fashion. So I believe that there is also lack of capacity on the side of the current political elites, and the art of diplomacy, in my view, has been in decline.
Well, Mr. Shoshkichin, I believe it's also the Western phrase that what you give is what you get. So I guess it's not much a surprise that the West increasingly finds itself in a minority. Nevertheless, this is all we have time for. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.